Economic Charter of Rights. How did you arrive and propose this economic charter?
Well, my passion for the horses took place when I started my business in 1957. I arrived in Toronto in 1955. I had $200 in my pocket and didn't know anybody. But after a while, I found a job in a small tool and die shop. There were about 10 employees. And after a few months, the owner said to me, "Frank, you're doing a great job. I want you to be a partner of mine." My chest swelled a little. But he was a nice fellow, but he never wrote it down. So I figured, well, there's nothing to it to run the business. So I looked in the papers where I could get a higher salary, and I left. I rented a very small room. The toilets and the showers were out in the hallway. By 57, I had $5,000 saved up. In 1957, I think $5,000, you could buy a small condo, a small farm. So anyway, what I did with it was I rented a building. It was the gatehouse of American Standard, a very large American company in Toronto on Dufferin and Dupont. There was a gatehouse, about the size of a six-car garage, right? I rented that building and bought a few used machines for the $5,000. And out I went hustling. You know, I went in the factories and I said, "I'm very good in solving problems. And if I don't solve them, you don't have to pay me." But anyway, after 1 month, I hired an employee. After 1 year, I had about 10 employees. And after 2 years, I had about 20 employees. So that's, call it a start. And then,
that was the start of Magna International?
Yeah, no, at that time, I still was a private company, right? So the first, what I would call it an evolutionary process, was that I had a German fellow as my foreman. So I've known him he started in 57. And so I'm talking now 2 years later in 59. I said, "What's the matter with you, Herman, lately?" Well, he said, "Frank, I'd like to start my own business." I said, "I sympathize with that." So he was my first employee, right? So he knew how everything grew. So I said, "Look, maybe we should talk tomorrow. Maybe we could come up with a better solution." He said, "That's fine." Yeah. That evening I was talking to myself, if that foreman's going to leave me, that would stifle my growth. I didn't like that. The next reason I liked even less, if that foreman's going to leave me, I would have to work on myself. The next reason, the third reason was, if I hire a new foreman now and I don't show him how business is run, I still got to do all the work myself. And if I show a new foreman how business is run, after 1 or 2 years, they will come to the conclusion business isn't that difficult, and they would start on their own. But anyway, the next day I said to him, "Herman, why don't we start a business together? You own 1/3, I own 2/3. No more overtime. By the end of the year, we take some monies out and we leave some monies in and to further grow the business." He said, "You mean it?" I said, "Yes." We went right away to a lawyer and signed a contract. And that was his business. This was his factory. He hustled like crazy, right? He was so proud. And I said, "Gee, I'm a young guy, and all of a sudden I make a lot of money, right? I had the original factory, and now a new factory." So over the next 2 years, I took six more foremen, right? And I had
And each had their own factory. It was a decentralized model.
Each had their own factory, decentralized. Each had their own factory. They all had an ownership.
And they were each functioned as small businesses.
They each functioned as a small business, right? So, and each one made a lot of money, so we had a great cash flow. So when I looked further out in the world, you know, I could see this multi-billion dollar, I should say, at that time I was in the car business. We made car parts. So I saw this multi-billion dollar business out there, and I came to the conclusion I should also have the employees involved, not only the foreman, right? So I converted my private company into a public company, and I put in a corporate constitution. The corporate constitution, its basic principle was how we divide the profits. So 20% of the profits were paid to the shareholders as a form of a dividend. Then 10% the employees got over and above their wages. And 6% management got. 7% went in the research, and 2% went to the charity. The message, why I get so much into the details, is it's a role model.
And you saw unprecedented growth when the profit sharing program was put in place.
Yes, it's so that was amazing, right? When what I'd like to point out is when you share with employees in a tangible way, you release an incredible energy of outdoor proportions. And because the workers on the front line, you know, they can see where you can improve things, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, our profits went up the first year about 40%, the second year 100%, the third year 200%. So I said, gee, that's great. So I made more monies, the employees made more monies, and the managers made more monies. So I said, gee, that's a game changer. That's just great. And that sort of was, call it the philosophy, the beginning of Magna International.
And the precursor to the economic charter.
Yes, that also gave me then things to think about it, that to say, wouldn't it be great to eliminate poverty? Poverty is sort of, this is where, if there's a lot of poverty, this crime would drive in it. And
there's a massive divide between the rich and the working class.
Yeah, that too is, the divide is enormous, right? Between the rich and the working class. I think there's better statistics in the United States. In the United States, about 2% of the people hold about 50% of all the wealth. That means 2% of the people dictate to 98% of the people what's good for them, right? Because the 2% have an enormous influence. And I always refer to that as the golden rule. You know, the world has always been dominated by the golden rule and still is. I don't want to be dominated by anyone. If I feel that strong about the golden rule, I should not be able to dominate somebody either. So certain ideas came to my mind that said, gee, how can we dismantle the chains of dominations? And what I'd like to do is not to change the chains of domination, not via violent revolutions, via revolution of the mind, by proposing an economic charter of rights, okay?
And an economic charter would allow for economic freedom. How do you define economic freedom?
Well, it's a shame that such a small percentage of people are economically free. Economic freedom, as far as I can see it, should be achievable that when a person works for 25 to 35 years, let's say they start at 20 or 25 and work for 20, 50, 55, 60 years, they should own, let's say, a small condo, a small house, and maybe have $100,000 in the bank so they can supplement their pension fund, right? And this would allow people to enjoy life better, to pursue whatever makes them happy, right? Okay, so I think this would be, people would be happier, right? It would be a balanced society, right? I think we got to teach that in schools, that we, if we do things right, if you think about it, we should be able to do that, right?
You have been on the boards of many universities. What do you believe is the mandate of a university?
Well, the mandate of a university, straightforward, I would say, is to teach young people how to have a more civilized society and to maybe carry it a little further. And I should say, sometimes I'm a little critical about myself because I have been on the boards, I think, about 7 universities. And it never occurred to me, you know, what program should we teach? Universities have great faculties in regards to medicine, technology, art, but very little is done in regards to humanity, okay? So I'm saying universities would be an ideal institute, an ideal institution where we could teach humanity, or where we could teach or do research. What structure do we need which would lead to an ideal society? If we got no blueprint, how can we reach an ideal society? So that universities would be the ideal institutions because they have large lecture halls, right? Auditoriums. They could invite successful business to give their view about the world, right? In regards, might it be sports, might it be the arts, might it be technology, might it be medicine, because all those things play a role in a civilized society.
Would universities offer us the opportunity to create a roadmap that would increase the living standards in this country?
Well, universities, like I said, would be the ideal institutions. It's non-political. Okay, they should work on call it on the structure which would lead to an ideal society, right? And as you go along, there's always some fine tuning. But it's not done, right? We have there's just no blueprint. There's not even a hint, you know, what we should do, huh, to have a civilized society.
With the economic charter, you include 7 principles that you believe are common sense principles that anybody could stand by. It's a nonpartisan movement, it's an economic movement. Are those 7 principles a roadmap to increasing the living standards in Canada?
The 7 principles would be a roadmap to see that Canada will get on a very sound economic foundation. Right now, I'm very worried, you know, that when we take a look at the makeup of Canada, I think we have close to $2 trillion now on debt. Huh? Those are huge amount of monies, right? Every year, like the debt goes up because we don't balance the budgets. So, the kids, right? I mean, we would leave such amount of debt. How can they ever pay it back, right? To me, it's amazing that we don't talk about those things, right? So there's this enormous amount of debt. That is something like, you know, if a family has a house and they have a big mortgage on, but if the mortgage would be maybe as double what the house is worth, right? The kids, when they would inherit, they would walk away, right? Because look, it's impossible, right? But the Canadians can't walk away if our government creates so much debt. We have to pay it back, and history has shown it over and over, right? That countries have to pay it back. And the countries will go to very severe restrictions and hardships, right? So,
and we really do not talk about the economy and what makes the economy function. What is the importance of Canadians understanding that?
I think the foremost principle in the Economic Charter of Rights is based upon on the economy, the economy, the economy. All politicians and all business people agree if the economy doesn't work, nothing else will work. We cannot feed the hungry. We cannot look after the most fragile people, the elderly, the sick, and the handicaps. But we do not talk what drives the economy. The economy is driven by three forces: smart managers, hardworking employees, and investors. The message I want to get across loud and clear is workers have a moral right to some of the profits they help to generate. So the clear message is, without workers, you could make a profit. So sometimes I wonder if the very rich, because we don't teach that, right, in schools, we don't teach it. To me, it's amazing that we don't teach what are the three driving forces, right? But then I think that the very rich don't want to share the profits with workers. So I like to bring that in the open. I like that we dismantle the chains of domination, the golden rule, because centuries ago, you know, when the king, you know, taxed the farmers too much, right? The farmers could see he had a castle up on the hill and he had revolutions. But now you don't see the kings no more. They might be in Hawaii, they might be in Beverly Hills, they might be in Monaco, but it's still there, right? Because it's so fundamental, the economy, the economy, the economy. So that should not be that difficult to do, right? In essence, the message I want to get across is the Human Charter of Rights alone is not sufficient. We have to fortify it with an economic charter of rights. Economic charters of rights will lead to economic democracies, and economic democracies are the basis for democracy itself. So the economic charter of rights should really be part of the Canadian Constitution. To fortify the human charter of rights, we need an economic charter of rights.
You believe in capitalism, but you believe capitalism needs harnessing at this point.
Yes, I believe, I'm saying, we should not destroy the capitalistic system. We should harness it. We should take a look, how can we harness? And I would classify small companies below 300 employees. And my recommendation would be that small companies can operate under the pure free enterprise system or the capitalistic system, purely, right? There will only two rules will apply: workplace safety, and you cannot dump poison chemicals in your backyard. But otherwise, we should be able to dismantle the red tape. The message I want to get across to small business, if you band together, you the small business, you can create a grassroots movement to dismantle the red tape. And if small business does well, the whole country will do well, right? Because when I built Magna, you know, we had over 400 small factories. They were large, because we had automation, we had robotics, but we only, I allowed about 200 employees, and then you had to build a new one. So I wanted to make sure that workers don't become a number, okay? Because when workers become a number, then things don't work. The most important thing is that you have happy employees.
So and you made partners out of your workers.
Yes, do I. So when I look back in history from, call it from the caveman to the hunted, to the kings and to the servants, and now we have an environment with bosses and disgruntled employees. I made sure I treated my partners as, I treated my partners, the workers as my partners, right? Every day when I went into the office or in the factory, I asked myself, what do I have to do that workers respect me? So we had perhaps maybe the most stringent, the most advanced human resource structure.
Magna had in place an open door process that allowed your employees to be able to call in an anonymous hotline and suggest changes that should be made that would make them happier employees.
Yes, because when you got so many employees, right? When I was small and had a few hundred employees, I know everybody, what they liked, you know. When hunting season, you had hunted, they had days off. What I saw you, it was when I saw some workers worked harder, I paid them more. Especially if you work hard and smart, you made even more money. You don't need any rules. You know, you need no paperwork, right? So small business, part of the deal would be they would pay no business tax because small business wants to grow, right? To grow, that means you got to hire employees. They pay a wage tax. The employees will pay a wage tax. And governments make more money on wage taxes than on business taxes, right? So this would be an enormous, it would create so many jobs. And the economy would function, and the country would make more profits. We could pay back the debt. So it's small business is really the driving force.
So you had just mentioned simplifying taxes. Is that the tax code right there?
that is the tax code here, huh? There's thousands and thousands of paragraphs in there which are so convoluted, which it doesn't make sense. Okay?
The average person would not be able to understand.
No, it should
that.
Be. Look, the average person, citizens should understand what are the rules of the country. If the rules are so complex, you know, that citizens just don't understand. So the question is, why is it so complex? The tax code, it really serves privileged corporations, right? Corporations or individuals which are very rich, which can afford many tax specialists. There's hundreds of thousands of tax specialists, right?
Who find the loopholes.
Okay. We don't need that, right? We don't need that because it should be black and white, with no loopholes. And the high school student should be able to fill out the taxes. It's mainly income tax, right? And if you make more money, you pay more taxes, right? In the economic charter, I have a tax schedule, right, which people can look up and be satisfied that it's fair, etc., etc. So, but anyway, the problem is we're way overregulated, way overregulated.
Bureaucracy is ballooning. We have 370,000 federal bureaucrats. How do we reduce bureaucracy without a chainsaw approach?
I think we have much more than this. When you take the municipal, the provincial, the federal, but let me, where people could understand, right? But 50 years ago, when the first computers came on the market, the slogan was, if you got one of those computers, you could eliminate a total office floor. When I look around now in North America, the United States, Canada, I see in every city maybe 20 times more office buildings. What they do in there, in the office, they don't make products in there. So it's regulations, regulations, regulations. We are over-regulated. And that brings me, of course, we need regulations. We need regulations in the food industry, in the building industry, in the medical industry. Of course we need. But we can over-regulate. And the same thing where I could say, look, when a young couple gets married, they hope and pray, gee, do we get healthy children? And they cannot lock up their kids in a rubberized room to make sure they don't get hurt. So, you know, you kind of talk to them as a parent, be careful about this, be careful about that. But you got to give them some room. You cannot micromanage. The same in the economy, it's even less thing, huh? Because you could do maybe less damage to things, like, so we gotta get away from micromanaging.
Would you be able to build Magna up to what you did, when you did, in today's environment?
I could never build Magna nowadays. Just imagine now, I built a company with 180,000 employees from a garage up, and over 180,000, about one third were women, right? About 60,000 of our labor force were women, and 80,000 and 120,000 were men. So a total of 180,000. I could never build it anymore, right? So we gotta get back. We have overdone it. Huh? We have overdone it with bureaucracy. There was just recently a service done. I remember three names. Canada had 100 bureaucrats per 1,000 people. The United States had 70 bureaucrats per 1,000 people. And Japan had 40 bureaucrats per 1,000 people. And even that is too much, okay? So I really, you know, 40, 50 years ago, when I built a factory someplace, a township said, gee, it's great you build a factory here. If you need any help, you know, this or that. But yes, we had a building code with engineers, which made sure the building could carry the snow load, the wind load, the sewage capacity, etc. So we had good engineers. Everything worked fine. And we could get a lot of things done. So and I'm not saying we should fire bureaucrats. In a civilized society, I don't want to point fingers. And whatever we do, it's got to be corrected in a civilized way. Because in a civilized society, a person's got the right to find a job, whatever the system is, okay? Well, whatever the openings are, but the key is politics doesn't work anymore. We got to change the system. And that brings me to, when I look back in history, which politician did I have a great respect, or I might call it which statesman, huh? It was Winston Churchill. In his later years, he said, gee, Parliament doesn't work. We have to balance out the politicians with citizens. He said, we need a chamber of citizens that Parliament can work. So in my case, that would be very, the best chamber of citizens would be the small business, because they all will play on the same level playing field. So we gotta we got to make sure that small business will, many other business because of the red tape.
Will small businesses help propel the Canadian Economic Charter?
Yes, this is what I would try to do. First of all, you never can change things. The timing has to be right, okay? But I'm very worried about the time. At the time, times will be very tough, you know? I think the fridge is gonna be half empty, okay? You could never change things, and you shouldn't change things. If the society, if the economy works well, why change, right? Okay, but we have, the living standards are so much lower now than 40, 50 years ago. 40, 50, 60 years ago, an ordinary couple, let's say a plumber and a school teacher, could buy a home, right? And maybe only one person had to be at work, right? We can't do that anymore. It's frightening. And so I think it's very important, right? If we give small business, if we take off the red tape, it would be, we could create so many jobs, huh? Because now what we have now is that's climbing like crazy. The bureaucracy is climbing like crazy and the imports are climbing like crazy. That's like a freight train going down the hill with no brakes on it, right? So it's gotta be, we have to do things and the economic charter would bring Canada back on a healthy foundation. In the economic charter, there's some principles involved, and they're all civilized, no chains operation. One, over 20 years, we got to eliminate the debt. Number two, we got to bring the bureaucracy down on maybe on the 20 or 30% of the population, right? And we got to have a tax system is black and white, no loopholes, okay? That's the third. And number four, we gotta be supportive and small business gotta unite to get rid of the red tape.
We need to unchain small business.
Yes, and when small business go large, the fifth principle in the economic charter rights is, then business would have to share the profits with the employees.
How do you define a large business?
The large business would be above 300 employees. So below 300 employees, it's small business. And pure free enterprise, pure above 300. So you as a business bank, do you want to go above? Or do you want? But I think business would like to grow for the simple reason they know if they share with workers, they make more monies. Okay, so that's a great thing. And that brings me now to the principle six, where one of my great worries is we can't make things anymore. Huh?
And we have a shortage of trades.
We have trade and skilled labor, a huge shortage, right? And when I run Magna, I had the largest skilled labor pool in the world.
And your most successful managers.
Yes, I had over 6,000 tool and die makers, right? Tool and die makers means they make the machinery to make products. Might it be a pen, might it be a bump on a car, a door, or might it be a bottle, right? You need tool and die makers, which make the machinery to make products. And it's a dying out breed, huh? Okay. I had a great school where we trained skilled labor, right? So we got that should be the number one priority over everything else, that every province should have a skilled training school where we.
And would this apply to all students, or would it be special schools
No, students should have a choice, right? I'm saying high school should enter grade 10, then students grade 11 and grade 12 should be exposed to trade. If they be exposed to trade, that is a win-win for the students because it gives them extra knowledge. The thing is, a student, the important thing is how can you accumulate knowledge, right? And so for 2 years, grade 11, grade 12, you'll be under the trades. If you want to go to university, you still can go to university. So it'd be a win for the students. They have more knowledge. It'd be a win for society. We could start making things again, right? Because by making products, that's the only way you can have a high living standard. That's the only way. And so so that would be, and that brings me now to point seven, which is very dear. No Canadian kid should go to school hungry. That means breakfast has to be served. No Canadian kid should leave the school hungry. That means lunch has got to be served. And by law, the food would have to be organic.
Canada is the only G7 country in the world with a national food program. Do you propose that we instate a national food program that's organic?
Yes, that's absolutely, I think it's also necessary because...
How can we afford this with organic food being as expensive as it is?
The question is, why don't we do it, right? Okay, because the cost would be a lot cheaper if we have organic food. So what we have, I decided about 12 years ago to go away from the large cars, right? Because we had factories where we built cars, right? We had a factory, Magnet factory, where we built all the Mini Coopers, so we shipped them all over the world. We developed the Aston Martin. We were actually a major car company. Anyway, I decided about 12 years ago to get away from and go into the agriculture because I consider myself very blessed with a good mind and good health. And I don't want to be a hypocrite, right? When we're young, we all hustle a bit to make some money that we can live in dignity and help the family. So I've created factories in 34 different countries. I could live in any one of those countries in dignity. I choose Canada.
Why Canada?
Canada is a great country, great people, but we gotta straighten out. We have the regulators took over. We gotta put some common sense to it that things won't work. That when we micromanage things, right? So Canada is, so, you know, I know when I bring forward, right, that our tax system is totally convoluted. I know that will cost many tax lawyers, many tax experts, right? We gotta make sure capitalism is good for the masses, not just for a few people, right? That's the difference. We gotta do that, right?
We need to even out the playing field.
So so I knew when I said, look, we have a simplified tax system. I know I will wind up with a lot of boys and arrows. You know, who is that stronger guy which recommends, you know, we should have a simplified tax system. But the fact is, if you don't know how to make products, you will not understand the economy. It's an amazing that most people, right, don't understand the economy because very few people can make products, right? So I want to bring the thing forward, right? I have a conscience. My conscience tells me, Frank, this country's gone totally out of the whack. What a great country. What a shame. What great people. And so I brought things forward. I waited till I held a certain age. I could not do it when I ran Magna. So I stepped back from Magna. And I could point out where we are way offside, where the country cannot work. To bring the country back on a sound economic footing, Okay. And so do I like that there's a lot of dirt thrown? Of course I don't like it. But does it, you know, I have a certain age, you know, so if I die in a few years, I die happy because I know I've done the right thing for Canada and its people. And I'd like to see Canada the first country in the world which will adopt the Economic Charter, which will put it in the Constitution to be a role model for the world. I hope that I'm still alive when that will take place, but I know I opened the door. You cannot shut the door. The door will be opened and there will be an Economic Charter of Rights. It would be nice if I'm alive, I still would see it, you know? But maybe if I do, I'm 92 years young now, and I hope that I could reach about 100 years in 8 years. I do hope that Canada is the first country in the world which will establish an Economic Charter of Rights to take off the chains of the Golden Rule, okay?
The chains of domination.
The chains of domination. Right, so this, what I propose, is a civilized revolution. I'm not proposing we should take away from the rich. I know, I'm just saying, look, without workers, we can't make a profit. Let the workers participate when we bake an economic pie. They're entitled to a slice. And
we saw the success of that with Magna.
Yes, and that would lead... The real mission is, because there were times when I was hungry, not because I wanted to lose weight. I was hungry. I had no money to buy food.
You've seen the lowest lows and the highest highs.
If you experience that, it's so deeply burned into your soul, huh? So every time when I start, what do I have to do to eliminate poverty? So in that slowly led me to the Economic Charter of Rights. And I think, I don't think you find people which have achieved what I have achieved, right? To manufacture, to create products, to understand the economy, okay? And so I had to wait, because I know if I want to change it, there will be a lot of poison errors. But I hope Canada will wake up, and most people will wake up and say, we got to do something. We got to share profits with the employees. Okay, so,
So you're turning 92 years young next week.
Yes.
You've seen the lowest lows, the highest highs. What is your advice to the youth?
Well, my advice is, I've seen the lowest of the lows, the highest of the highs is, to young people, focus on today to stay alive. But leave the door open for tomorrow and follow your dreams and be guided by your conscience.
Mr. Stronach, we've talked a lot about your mission. Can you tell us, what is your passion?
Well, my passion is, I really got to know horses and fell in love with horses. Horses, when they look back in history, played a great service to mankind. Where would California be, or the whole world, right? I mean, horses plowed the fields, horses moved people, so, and horses are... It's such a powerful animal, so beautiful, and it gets along well with people, right? So anyway, how I got into it, when I started my business in 57, I worked like 5 years like crazy, right? Saturday, Sunday, every day, 7 days a week, about 14 hours every day. After 5 years, I had a little money in the bank, not to be worried anymore that I ever would go hungry. But so I thought, gee, I do all those technologies. I need something which is connected with nature. And so, yeah, it was like cowboy movies. So I saw John Wayne riding out in the sunset and said, gee, I would like to do that one of those days. So I looked in the papers, horses, riding horses for sale. It was on a Saturday morning. I went to the first farm, bought the first horse I saw. And in the afternoon, I was riding. But that farmer had a few race horses, so he took me to the racetrack, and I found it very interesting, very, So after a while, I bought a yearling, a racehorse. That was about in 63, you know. That was my first horse. I laid out, $700 and bought a yearling. $700 in those days would be now like maybe like $20,000, something like. So I bought my first yearling. And then I bought a farm, bought a number of farms, bought more horses, and I wound up early with some great horses, with some champions. And those great horses run into the great racetracks in America.
And you built many of these great racetracks. Yeah, no,
the racetracks were on hand. I call it, I modified them, you know, I redid them. So besides having a farm, besides having kids, right, and kids usually are quite interested in horses while they are young, right? When I was in Toronto, right, so Saturday and Sunday, we as a family went to the racetrack, right? Okay, that was our daily. But then I started to buy racetracks because I thought they were badly run. And I started to modify, to bring racetracks up to a certain standard, because I thought that the food was kind of really bad, you know. And I'm a great stickler, So pretty well all the racetrack had the director's room, which was kind of lavish, great food, great everything here, right? I know it one time, I had a horse at Santa Anita. That was sort of the premier racetrack in Los Angeles. I had a horse run there, and it's customary when you have a horse run in a big race that you invite it in the director's room. But my problem was I had an open shirt, I had no tie. So we had to wear a tie in the director's room. So they found a tie, you know, and so I had a thing here. So I said to myself, one of those days they're going to buy the place and change the rules, which I did. I bought it and changed the rules. So anyway, I changed the rules on a lot of racetracks. But what really, I came to thinking about it, you know, as Catholics flock to Rome, as Muslims flock to Mecca, the Jewish people flock to the Wailing Wall. I say, look, I want to do something where people which love horses would flock there and admire the horses
So you built the largest bronze statue in the world.
Yes, I believe it's the largest. It's not the highest, but it's the longest, huh? So I looked in hundreds of horse books to come up what kind of theme should it be? How can I inspire people, right, in regards to horses? So anyway, I came to the conclusion, you know, Pegasus is it's a Greek mythology, you know, and the dragon. And so basically I said, the world has always been inspired by the good spirits and bad spirits. So the horse is the good spirit, the dragon is the bad spirits, right? So I did some sketches, then I hired one of the foremost artistic creators, you know, in in Los Angeles. I think he worked for Disney at the time. And I explained to him what I wanted to do. So he made a small model, and we modified the model. Then we made a larger model. Let's say, yeah, that's the model I would like to see. And so, which led to a massive, right? It's the Pegasus horse is 115 feet tall, and with the drag and with the length, it's about 300-400 feet. So it is the largest sculpture, bronze sculpture, right? Not the highest one, but in length. Because you see the beggar standing on the rocky area with waterfalls coming down and a fountain kind of thing, and he's fighting the dragon, okay? So I think this was where a lot of kids will see that, right? Kids like excitement, and basically it should be exciting for the kids, and I want to provoke the minds of grown-ups, right? That we are faced every day where we got to make decisions. Is it good or bad? Is it correct or wrong? Is it constructive or destructive? But I mean, so, my daughter kind of took up the horse business now, right?
Because at one point you were the largest city landowner.
Pretty well, yeah. My daughter is pretty well the largest city landowner. You know?
And you created economies around your horse.
Yes, because racetracks or the horse industry has a lot of labor involved. Not high-tech labor, right? But not everybody could be in high-tech, right? A lot of people like the low-tech, where, you know, people which care for what they're so happy. You know, being around horses, it's very low tech, grooming, feeding the horses, right? So, but that's a way to happiness for a lot of people, right? But anyway, from the economic thing is, there's over a million people involved directly in the horse industry and indirectly about 5 million. So it's a major economic block in the, call it in the US economy. But going back, so yeah, there's changes, there's challenges. I think Belinda now kind of accumulating experiences. I think, you know, as the father, you're always a little critical, you would do it a little, but I think she's doing okay now. She's starting to get a handle on it. And she gave a great speech to call it on the Eclipse or what dinner. I thought that was a very great speech. And my son, naturally, my daughter, Belinda, and my son, we always went to the, he really developed a passion for the horses.
Your son, Andrew Stronach, is known for being really good with the bloodlines and being able to compute.
Yeah, he's got a reputation that he cannot do a computer on the bloodlines. You know, he can go back many generations and say, that horse is by such and such bloodlines, this and that. And he made a contribution. We had some great horses where he picked the bloodlines, right? So I should say thank you for that. Well, we do a lesser thing here, you know, with the years. So we all, we all try to do our thing here and life goes on. But the most, well, as a father is, you love your kids, good or bad, you love them equally, right? Okay, so I hope to get that across. And I like to see, the family kind of grew up in Aurora in Canada, a little north of Toronto. And the family did very well because all our thousands of employees were from that area. And because of thousands of employees, I want to leave a legend there. I do that Aurora with its great people, we were able to do extraordinary thing. And I like to leave a legend there by building something very spectacular.
In Aurora.
In Aurora.
Well, you have already in Aurora built out a lot of the community centers.
Yes,
but so you've really given back to the community.
Yeah, but I have a few things in mind which would be, I think, which would, Aurora would be a destination spot. Yeah.
Incredible. Incredible. And you also got into the micro-mobility EV space.
I wanted to get away from the large electric cars because of the greenhouse gases. When you've been traffic jams for hours every day, it's very bad for you, right? I don't want to be a hypocrite. I was in there, but I decided maybe it's not the right thing for me. But funny enough, about 2-3 years ago, the premier called me and said, Frank, you got a problem. General Motors is closing. You know the car industry. What would you recommend? So anyway, I had to go down a few times. What used to take me half an hour from the outer ring to the inner ring in Toronto takes me now, when everything's fine, would be an hour, but it could take 2 hours. So I got stuck a few times in traffic jams, and I came to the conclusion the only way to solve that would be small electric cars, micro-mobility. So I built a new factory now. We just got the first cars off the line, and I'm very confident that those cars, the micro-electric mobility, will play a major role in transporting
people. They'll change the landscape of transport.
Will change the landscape, yeah.
And you've also gotten, as you had mentioned earlier, into organic agriculture.
Yes, earlier, I assessed myself and I said, gee, nature gave me a good mind and good health. What can I do for society? So I decided I want to go into the agriculture, right? A country which could feed itself never had a problem. And family farms were the backbone of countries, okay? But it's sad to see family farms are practically on welfare. So I think we got to do something about it, especially the Economic Charter of Rights, the seven principle refers to organic foods, right? So I'm saying family farms, we have to make sure that family farms survive. We got a great, Canada must create a family farm trust fund. Where we want to see that young farmers will go back into the farming, because farming to produce food is the most noble thing to do. But right now, family farms got to compete with industrial farms. Industrial farms, 95% of the food eaten in North America comes from industrial farms. And in industrial farms, you see no more eagles fly because there's no more rabbits, there's no more pheasants. We spray so much pesticides and fungicides that we kill everything. So people have no ideas the chemicals they eat, and all the kids. I got into it because I noticed all the kids had allergies. Stage 2 diabetics enormously on the rise. Okay, so we got to do something about it. So that's part of the economic charter whereby kids must have access. All kids, not only rich kids, but also kids from working class with less income, must have the chance to grow up healthy. And the only way to grow up healthy is if you eat if you stay away from chemical foods. If you eat chemical foods, you won't grow up healthy. We have a lot of problems. So those are very, play a great role in the economic charter, in the lives of people, and people saying we cannot afford organic. It would be the total wrong statement, because the costs of sicknesses, the medical costs, are in the billions, okay, to treat cats, et cetera, et cetera. So there'd be huge savings. So it'd be totally wrong.
And you've created a business model where you have an organic greenhouse, an organic farm, a food plant, where you freeze the food and you're able to reheat it so that you reduce waste, which will also make organic food more accessible.
Yes, I put my head around a lot and say, what can I do? And as I said, I consider myself blessed with a good mind, that I'm inquisitive, I want to know things, get right down into the roots. And I came to the conclusion, you know, we got to make sure that family farms can survive. And that when they, large industrial farms, it's practically impossible to do organic farming, because nature needs biodiversity, right? It needs different species of fruits and vegetation. There's different species then of insects, etc. Nature is an amazing thing. They balance themselves pretty well out, right? Okay, so it's a very interesting subject. So I'm building a role model. I'm talking about permits, right? Talking about bureaucracy. I'm waiting 3 years now to get a building permit to build a farmer's market.
Wow.
Okay, where we have cooking facility, where we want to teach mothers how to cook low cost, healthy organic food, huh? Where we gonna teach them? Okay, so it's a shame, right? I mean, what we do, right? So, but again, we gotta in a logical way, in a civilized way, we gotta dismantle and grow a Canada which with a good, solid economic footing, economic charter, and eliminate poverty.